Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Sometimes I can't sleep after I've interviewed you. You got me all riled up with this stuff.
Well, George, that makes two of us. I mean, there's many nights where I'll go through a case and I'll go lay in bed and just gather my thoughts. And sometimes my thoughts are out there with the people in the woods that have disappeared. And it's not a comforting feeling.
Oh, my gosh. It really is. By the way, a couple months ago, I had a great opportunity to interview David for our Beyond Belief television program. He is as riveting on the radio and on television as in person. And, David, just great information.
Well, George, you're very kind, very kind. But the truth of the matter is that you're probably one of the most polite people in the public spectrum I've met in a long time. And it was an honor to be on your show, and I appreciated the invitation.
So what is new in the field of these missing people?
Well, you know, about it. 2 or 3 years ago, when I was in the middle of investigating rural disappearances, several people came to me and they said, you know, I know that you're one of those people out there that keeps an open mind and keeps your spectrum open, but one of these days you're going to move from the woods, those rural areas, and you're going to come into the city because the profile points that you've identified on these cases, they're going to transition. You are just going to find it. It's just going to be a matter of time. Truth of the matter is I was so occupied with looking at people who have disappeared in the national parks and forests in North America that I was probably a bit taken by that statement, and I kept my mind open, and some things came along and some people sent me some emails, and sooner or later I got to the point where I was looking at cases of college-aged men that disappeared in their unusual conditions, predominantly in the Great Lakes region, but also along the East Coast area of the U.S. And there were some common denominators there that also reflected upon the disappearances we were looking at in rural areas. And after studying that for a year, a few months back, I came out with a fifth book called Missing 411, A Sobering Coincidence. And the factors on that is that canines can't track the people to where they disappeared. They almost seem to disappear under the noses of their friends and family. And many, many times they're found in an area that had been searched sometimes 10 times. And this is the same profile points that happen in the rural disappearances.
Just amazing.
Now, one of the weird things is that many times when these people are found, the search and rescue people are never thinking criminal act. They're always thinking, my gosh, we found somebody, whether they're dead or alive, we found him and we can get closure. And they're not trained investigators, and usually when they're found, the body's turned over to the coroner. Yeah, they died in the woods and that would be the end of it. Now, with cases in the water, it brings on an entirely different perspective on the way the body reacts to water, and there's certain things that the body does in certain periods of time in the water that it doesn't do on land, and they're readily identifiable. And after looking at a series of cases where there were secondary autopsies, and in some cases where the original medical examiner was honest and would face the consequences. Say the person disappeared 7 days ago, the coroner would come out and say, well, they might have disappeared 7 days ago, but they've only been in the water for 2 days.
Huh.
And, George, this doesn't happen once or
no.
twice. This has happened many
over,
times.
Over and over too.
And then, on top of that, many times, the coroner comes back and says, yeah, we can't determine what caused the death of these people. And this has happened also in these rural disappearances. And when you try to stay confined to certain points that you've identified and you don't want to wander, then it excludes a lot of perimeter cases that we might have looked at, but the reality of it is that we're trying to stay to that straight criteria. Now, some other detectives were working on something similar to this, and they used the cases and they identified them as the smiley face killers. And they claimed that in certain instances they would find some graffiti next to the site where the people were found. And these guys, a guy named Gannon, who's retired from New York police, I give the guy a lot of credit because most detectives don't want to work missing persons cases. They want to work homicide cases, robbery, homicide, etc.
Right.
But I tell you, Gannon from New York, he really paid attention to what was happening to these people in the Hudson River and in other rivers around that New York area. And he determined that certain bodies couldn't have ended up in locations where they did. He worked with coroners to figure out that the bodies weren't in the rivers as long as they were. And these guys were looking at it from a local area perspective. And when I looked at it, I knew that I had cases in rural areas that were not only in the United States and Canada, but they were also in seven other countries that exactly met this established profile. Well, I knew that if the profile went to these young men that were disappearing in these rivers, then it also probably was happening in other areas of the world.
Jeez. What about the cases that are happening around British Columbia, Canada, where feet are showing up on shore? Just feet. They're not finding bodies, but feet.
You know, we looked at that because in the part of the profile points that we've identified is that people are missing shoes and clothing many times when they disappear. And then we started looking at these feet, and some of them have been found on the Northern California coast, and some have been found on lakes and things in North America and in British Columbia. Now, there's an entire series of these in the Vancouver area where they haven't been able to identify anybody. And they've got DNA, and they have the shoe, and they have the foot, but they can't really talk much more about it because some coroners have claimed that the foot comes off first if they're in the water a long period of time, but they should be able to put that foot with a missing person if they have the DNA.
You would think so. My God. Somebody would report, hey, my son's missing, my friend, whatever.
Right. Exactly. And you bring up the point about British Columbia, and I get questions all the time from Canada, and I know that there's a lot of people from there listening right now. And the area of lower British Columbia, in that Vancouver, northern Vancouver area, there are so many people that have disappeared. And I've got a couple friends that live in that area, and they tell me all the time, hey, there's people disappearing up here. And the news does the same thing here as they do in the States. They report it for the first couple days, maybe up to 4 or 5 days, but then you never hear about it.
Then they stop. Then they go on to the next tragedy.
Exactly. And why are these people disappearing? How are they disappearing? And if they're found, what are the circumstances? And you really don't hear a lot about it. 99% of the time, these people are hiking alone. They get ahead of the group. They're behind the group. One way or another, they aren't seen when they disappear. And they're usually found in areas that baffle the investigators. And it doesn't matter if it's a Canadian or a U.S. search and rescue person, sometimes when they get on the media, they're stumped. They can't answer the question how the person got to where they were found.
And let me ask you this, David. Of what's the percent of those people who disappear who are found dead?
So in this profile that we've established, that's really the only one I can talk to, is I would say it's probably 30-40%,
all right,
maybe slightly higher. But then the people that are found, the uniform issue with them is they don't know how they got missing. They don't remember how they went missing. They can't explain where they were. It's like a very unusual memory loss.
All right. Of that percent, 30 to 40%, maybe a little higher, that are found dead, then what's the percent of those who are found alive? And again, they don't remember or anything like that, but what's that percent? Found alive.
Found alive, I would say probably 50, 55, maybe 60%.
That high, okay. So there's a percent, though, that we just don't know where they are, right?
Very high percentage, yes. of that 40% that are left, I would say those that are gone, maybe 10 to 15% we can't find.
Totally vanished.
And George, I'm not talking about some small effort to find this group. There is enormous effort to find them. We're talking about FLIR in the sky. We're talking about multiple canine blood-sniffing bloodhounds. We're talking about sometimes people walking shoulder to shoulder. And we're talking about covering the area multiple times.
Yeah, one person sends you an email from North Carolina, James. He said, of these people who are found, do they still have blood in their bodies? Interesting question. I never asked you that.
So there are a few unusual cases. It's called exsanguination, where some bodies are found and there's no blood in them. And I've written about that in some of my books, and it's really unusual. It's not a common trait. And
listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
In my last book, I wrote about a woman that disappeared, and that they had that issue, and they couldn't find enough blood to do tests on her in the body. And the unusual part of that was that they couldn't find any wounds on the body that would account for the loss of blood.
Almost like they're vampire people out there.
Yeah, you know, except that you would think with a vampire-type incident, there'd be marks or something.
Or something.
There never is on these.
Now, in the book series, we've got, what, four different books, Missing 411?
Five.
Five now. And what's the latest on your movie documentary?
So we just got back about a week ago after a lengthy trip up through Idaho, Washington, Oregon, and back down through northern Colorado, where we did an entire series of interviews, and it was phenomenal. And I can tell you that I'm really critical of the interviews, and if they aren't going well or if the information isn't good, I'm one going to speak up and say, hey, this is crap.
That's true. You don't hold back.
But the reality is that some of the people we found to interview, George, just came to the plate. And
beautiful.
Sometimes the cases that I wrote about where we went out to find an interview victim, sometimes the story is even stranger after you get into the minutiae of the data than it was when I originally wrote about it. And we've got some pretty big name people that some others out there in the world are going to recognize in the movie that stepped up and wanted to participate with us that are experts. And then we have some county sheriffs in some areas that absolutely confirm the strangeness of some of the cases that I've written about. So I think right now we're doing really well. We should be finished filming by the end of December. It'll then go to editing, and that could take months. So I tell people, don't expect anything before September, October.
Okay. And initially, David, these were all around the park systems. Have you started looking at, you know, cities where people have disappeared too?
You know, we're staying with that disappearance of college-aged men that have disappeared in a city environment that fit a profile. And we can talk more about that later, but
okay.
The reality of it is it's really exact. It's college-age, educated young men. Most of them are big-time athletes. Most of them are on scholarships for either academics or athletics. We're talking about the cream of the crop young men that have vanished.
That's right. And what about race? Does that matter?
Predominantly white males. And I've stated in my past books, and it's staying continuous here, German descent.
Now, how in the heck, if someone is taking them, I'm just saying if, how would they know their nationality?
That's the part.
That's weird.
It's truly baffling. I don't know what to say.
I mean, would somebody have access to their dossier or something? That's strange.
Well, when you get into it, you realize that it can't be something normal. This has to be something so far outside the bounds of what you and I and everyone else understands, because these young men are so smart, so athletic, so easygoing sometimes.
Top of the line.
Yes, exactly. There aren't any vagrants that I've written about that have stumbled into the river and drowned. These are unknown circumstances of how they got in the river that baffle the cops.
Are they generally spotted by somebody an hour or two before they disappear?
Sometimes, but again, that time of the disappearance, they don't know, because a lot of times the person, in many instances, they're in a bar drinking with friends, and their friends say, all of a sudden, we lost contact with him. We don't know where he went. We texted him, we phoned him, and it was like under their noses, the person disappeared.
Like a guy said, I'm going to go to the restroom, and maybe he does, maybe he doesn't, but he never comes back.
Exactly.
Jeez. Unbelievable. David, I'm going to go through some cases with you and have you update us on some people. With basically a list of these people. But this is shocking. This isn't getting solved, is it?
Well, you know what I tell people is when I give a presentation, to me it's like spokes in a wheel. And I started off with just one or two spokes, this missing young men in urban areas.
Mm-hmm.
This is another spoke in the wheel. And I've got a feeling the spokes are going to increase before we really solve this.
And when the inner city disappearances, what percent of those are found dead?
99%.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's a very scary high profile. There's only one case I know of where somebody disappeared and was found alive.
All right, we'll talk about that too then. We'll talk about those people disappearing in cities. And like David said, 99%+ are found dead. And David, those books are still available, are they not?
Yes, and I warn people not to buy them on Amazon, because there's resellers out there that are just ripping people off. But on our website, they're $24.95, canammissing.com.
You know, that's a good point, because I've seen some books that would sell retail for $19.95, and they're on Amazon for like $100. Crazy.
It's nuts. And every once in a while, I get an email from somebody saying, why are you charging so much? And I'm, not me.
Not you. No, not you at all. Let me go through some names of missing people, and you can give us updates or tell us the story behind them, okay?
Sure.
Neville Jewell from British Columbia.
So this kind of brings on a story about a very experienced hiker who's on the Howcrest Trail near Cypress Mountain in northern Vancouver area. Parked his car on this trail. Started walking. He texted his girlfriend at 2:00, said he was going to be home on time. He was in the West Lyon area. Didn't show up, didn't come back. They started a search right away. They pulled his cell phone forensics, and it kind of was showing some activity in a specific area, in a specific ridgeline of in the Capilano watershed. And for people who have been to northern Vancouver before, there's a famous Capilano suspension bridge, and that's in this area. They brought search dogs in. They never found a scent. Bad weather hit the area immediately after the search started. Another profile point. The other profile point being is that when canines can't find a scent in an area for the victim, that's something we pay attention to. Make a long story short, this happened September 12, 2015. They gave up the search, and Neville Jewell has never been found.
Never been found. So that's one of those percents. Poof,
right.
He's gone.
Right.
Sending texts to his girlfriend, and he's gone.
And I think that, you know, for the people who are listening to me for the first time, one of the vetting points that we do is that we take out the commonalities of, well, is it an animal attack? No, search and rescue eliminates that. It's not an animal attack. Could there be human predation in the area? Well, there's no evidence that a crime's ever occurred in this area before. So, is it easy to disappear in the wilderness? Well, maybe if you wanted to, but the people here that we're talking about, no mental illness issues, in happy relationships, non-suicidal. If they were suicidal, if there was sign of human predation, if there was sign of animal predation, that would eliminate it from our research.
Next up, Tom Billings. Tell us about Tom.
This is another tough one, 22 years old, in the same area as Neville. Trail runners said that they saw Billings just before he started the hike in the area of Lynn Canyon in the same general area. Well, scent dogs that were brought up into that area, they found nothing, even though the searchers had people that put him in a specific place. After that, they found nothing. This is in an area of Grouse Mountain, again in that Capilano area. He left his cell phone in his room because it was broken. He left his room at 9 a.m. that morning, telling roommates he'd be back by 9:45 that night. He discussed hiking this area of Grouse Mountain with his roommate. He was an extremely experienced hiker, and he had made big trips to Russia, Siberia, Belarus, Latvia, Israel. It's a lengthy list. This guy was well-known in the hiking circles, and it was confusing to friends and his father why he had tried to leave and make a hike on a mountain when he finally started at that base at about 2 p.m. He knew better than to do this, so it was confusing to him why he did. And a massive, massive search was inhibited by bad weather, and it was also inhibited by the fact they never found a scent in the area where they knew he was going to be. So we have two hikers now that have disappeared in the same area with the same profile points. Both have never been found.
How did these stories come to you? Do people share them now? Insiders?
It's unbelievable now, after doing this for a number of years, how many emails I get from people saying, you know, you really ought to look at this area, or you really ought to look at this case. And I will tell people, because it's funny, they hear you and I having a conversation, and maybe they've listened to three or four of our interviews, and they think that they understand what is happening here. And I can tell you that in all the interviews I've ever done, maybe 4 or 5% of all the facts and elements have come out in these 100 hours of interviews. But all the minutia of the facts is in the books, and that's really the meat of the issue.
That's right.
It's these little things where, like you said, he left his cell phone in his room. In a lot of the cases that we write about, the people didn't have any transmission with them. They didn't have a sat phone. They didn't have a cell phone. They didn't have an emergency transponder beacon that we tell people to carry. And for whatever reason, it seems to be more the norm than not.
Yet so many people are disappearing from these parks. I know some people now who have not, just because of listening to us, they have not gone on a park trip camping outing or anything like that. They've said, I'm not going.
You know, and I get this all the time. When you make an appearance, people come up to you and they ask you a million questions, and they say, well, you know, I've decided not to take my family here. And the reality is that I tell people, you should go, but just be cognizant that this isn't the safe haven that many have made the forest and the woods out to be, because it's unbelievable how quickly, especially a small child, can disappear even though you think they are in their presence, in the immediate presence of you. And then there's also, I think there's a macho-ness to some men about going into the woods and being able to survive. Yet I know dozens and dozens of cases of hunters that have gone into the woods and they've never come out. And I know that if they would have had an emergency transponder beacon with them, they would have lived.
They would have lived. That's right. David Koch, tell me his story.
Well, this one's a tough one. 36 years old. He disappeared May 25th, 2005. In the exact, and I'm talking the exact same area that Tom Billings disappeared 8 years later. He was an associate publisher and sales manager for a magazine called DM Review. It's an IT magazine. He's on a business trip to Vancouver, had a wife, and had talked about going up to Vancouver and being able to take these outdoor trips because he was an enthusiast of the outdoors. He took a trip to Grouse Mountain. He told his wife he was going there. And he was on one of the last trams to go up to the top of the mountain. It was about 7:30, 8 o'clock. He rode up there with 25 other people. It was all on videotape. He was wearing sandals, a t-shirt, and shorts. It was beautiful weather. And when he got to the top, showed him getting off the tram, and he walked over towards an atrium for a couple minutes, caught him on CCTV going back to the visitor's booth and or to the bathroom. Within a couple of minutes, the TV didn't see him anymore, and he disappeared. everything at that top of that mountain was open until 10 o'clock, and it was normal for people to go up there at that hours after work. Immediately after David disappears, the weather changes. The headlines for the paper in Canada were, "Weather hinders search for Heartland man missing in Canada."
That happens a lot, too, doesn't it? The weather just quickly changes.
Exactly. And they looked for him intensively for 10 days. 400 rescuers, multiple helicopters with FLIR, multiple bloodhound teams, in addition to hundreds of volunteer searchers. And it stated that it rained almost nonstop for the next 5 days from the time he disappeared. Now, fast forward, and he disappears on May 25th. June 7th, in an area 2,100 feet off of one of the trails on the mountain, in a pool of water, they found him deceased. Now, that area had been searched multiple times, and the searchers said they were confused that he was found there. Now, this is the part, and it goes back to the missing men who had been drinking in and were found in rivers. This is one of those cases that it's a dead-on match. The autopsy said that he died of hypothermia, but the medical examiner stated he went missing on May 25th, but Mr. Koch died 6 days later on May 31st. So where was he?
Where did he go for those days?
And end up right in the area in the middle of searching. Now, just for food for thought, he was also of German heritage. Things to think about. Where he was found was not where he perished, number one. There were no tracks going in and out of that area. Searchers specifically stated they found no broken branches, no clothing or threads of clothing in the area that they had searched and where he was found. And they said that this was the largest search in 10 years in that area.
It's almost as if, David, they go through some kind of dimension or some kind of door, and they come back later as if they find their way back in. It's weird.
A lot of people have told me that exact thing, George. Or some people use the word portal.
Yeah.
Other people have said, but you know what's confusing? Is that what were they doing during the days that they were missing and alive?
Exactly. If anything.
Yeah.
Were they suspended in some kind of animation? Who knows?
Well, what I'd be interested in, but many times the medical examiner won't release this part of the autopsy, is I'm interested in, what were the stomach contents that they found?
Mm-hmm. Good point. And you've had stories of people who have had somebody walking in a group, maybe the last person, and then they turn around and he's gone.
Well, there's a story written in the Huffington Post about my books, and they called the title of the story was Last in Line, and subtitle was Don't Be Last in Line. And that was, it should have really been, don't be last in line, don't be first in line, and always stay within close proximity to the people you're hiking with. Because it seemed as though that once you got out of view and out of sound range, or just around a corner, something happens and these people vanish.
The German connection with so many of these people being of German descent, is that new? Did you just uncover that, or has that been ongoing?
You know, it might be that maybe I'm a slow learner and it comes to me slower than some, but after a while, when you start seeing the same sort of names, and when descent of a person is talked about in an obituary, German comes up more than normal. So for the last 2 years, I've been paying real close attention to this, and I'll just talk about this summer, a man named Morgan Heimer, 22 years old, was a tour guide in a group of people along the Colorado River in Grand Canyon National Park. They were a couple days into their trip, and they pulled to the side two large boats of people, and they take the side trip up this creek. And the people go way up the creek, maybe a mile or so with their guides, and there's a big pool and a waterfall, and they kind of hang out. The creek's not even deep enough to drown in, per se. You know, you could walk across it ankle deep. But Hymer was in the back of the line when they were coming back on this creek excursion. He was wearing a life preserver, and he disappeared. And Morgan was a student at the University of Wyoming, and I can tell you that this shook up this tour group immensely. Somebody in that group heard about our work, and he called me, and he talked to me extensively about this and said, Dave, there was no place for Morgan to go. If he fell in the creek, he wasn't going anywhere. The sides of that canyon were straight up and down. And he was walking, and he was within a quarter mile of both boats and 50 people, or not 50, 30 people when he was walking. And nobody can believe he didn't make it back because they all thought he was right behind them. So they brought in a huge amount of searchers from the National Park Service, volunteers from the tour group. They searched that area for a week. They didn't find one trace of Morgan Hymer. Again, German descent.
Baffling. I mean, what does law enforcement tell you, David? And I'm sure it's not confidential. What do they think's going on?
Well, when I gave that talk in front of NASA in 2012, and I gave the talk just like I'm talking to you now, I wasn't holding anything back. And at the end of it, there were three Alaska state troopers there. And Alaska state troopers are in charge of all search and rescue in Alaska. And one in their group stood up and he said, Dave, you're saying something that everybody in this group, that they, if they've been involved in search and rescue for a long period of time, they know is truthful. Nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody wants to admit it's happening. And they want to analyze it away as just, well, that's unfortunate, or the dogs didn't want to search, or the person must have done something stupid to disappear. But he said, you know what? There's something else here, and people are going to have to wake up and listen to what you're saying. At the end of the talk, there was a line out the door of these searchers that wanted to tell their story of unusual things that people don't want to talk about.
You know, you would think that if law enforcement and government agencies were told about a threat that has resulted in hundreds of deaths, hundreds of disappearances dating back decades, maybe centuries, that it's been happening over much of the world, but is concentrated in particular epicenters, clusters, if you will, you'd think that officials would be interested in that. Please tell us more, they might say. What could be causing this, they might ask. You'd think. But in reality, government agencies and law enforcement have seen the evidence for themselves. They've been told about this. They know something is going on, something weird and dangerous, and the response has been a big fat zero, silence, and worse than silence. They've stonewalled efforts by private citizens to get to the bottom of this, going so far as to issue veiled threats and to throw up roadblocks to investigations. David Politis, a former police officer, now author and investigator, has chronicled this mystery in a series of books, Missing 411. He was the first to spot the patterns, the first to bring this to the world's attention, and he is still on the hunt for answers. We're pleased that he chose this forum to unveil his latest findings as detailed in this new book, Missing 411, The Devil is in the Detail. Dave, great to have you back on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, George.
Let's start this way. Did you know or did you guess back when you started down this road that you'd still be chasing the mystery years later, that you still would not have any solid answers, that it would take you this far and this deep?
I think during that initial phase, maybe the first 2 or 3 weeks, no. But then after we started to get responses from the National Park Service about not having lists of missing people, not wanting to give up lists of missing people, and wanting to charge exorbitant amounts for those lists if they had to put them together, things started to seem peculiar at that stage.
Let's get into the response, because I think the response, or lack thereof, from the agencies, the various agencies, is almost as interesting as the phenomena itself. Let's talk about, before we get into describing the parameters of the mystery, how the latest kind of roadblocks that have been thrown in your path.
Well, there's a couple of women that disappeared at Crater of the Moon National Monument in Idaho earlier last year. And during that, while they were missing, one, they walked out into the area together. They both went missing together. They had little dogs in their truck. Their family members said they'd never go out for a deep hike. They'd always stay within eyesight of the trucks, et cetera, et cetera. Well, one lady was found after a week. The other lady wasn't found for over a month. And at that point, we filed Freedom of Information Act requests against the Park Service for information about the disappearance, details about the search, And since they now had the bodies, information about what was the cause of death. And they stonewalled this for 7 months. And then they sent us the documents about a month ago and essentially gave us nothing. They stated that they weren't the lead investigating agency, even though it's on their property. They stated that they didn't write any reports other than a brief face sheet about the initial disappearance. That's it. They stated that if we want anything else, we had to go to that county jurisdiction because they didn't have anything. And then they stated something that we've never heard before, and we don't think it has legal precedent, and that is that they withheld photos of the crime scene and of various evidence, saying that they wanted to protect the privacy of the relatives. They knew that they have no standing on protecting the privacy of a deceased person, but that's the first time we've ever heard them make a claim that they're trying to protect the privacy of loved ones.
You think they know that you're one guy, that you have limited resources, that you're not going to hire some high-powered lawyer to come after them, and they're just going to get away with dragging their feet as much as they can?
Maybe they think that, but there have been some things that have come up in the last month that have been pretty interesting. Some people I know from technology have come to me who know about what's going on, and I've heard the same thing on the internet and via Facebook, etc., from people saying that we should start a Kickstarter campaign to get the $1.4 million to force them to cough up the list.
$1.4 million. My gosh.
They say that they don't have a list of missing people, and they say my books aren't in enough libraries to qualify for an author's exemption, but if I give them $1.4 million, they'll come up with the list.
It, just off the top of my head, I think you could do it for less if you hired a really high-powered lawyer who deals with Freedom of Information Act stuff and sick him on him. Because this can't be legal. It can't be right.
It doesn't seem like it. It doesn't have that feel-good effect. And I don't think that's what Freedom of Information was initially brought about for.
You've had wildly varying estimates, right? When you've had them where they've complied with a request, give you boxes of information at a low cost, and then they tell you some outrageous figure for what would seem to be a much smaller file.
It seems as though that certain files they'll readily give up, even on their own people. There's an individual, a ranger named Paul Fugate, who disappeared in Arizona while he was on duty, and they gave us a box full of documents for $40. It's still an ongoing case. There's some accusation that there's criminal element. Maybe he was abducted criminally, but they just gave us that. Other times, they said, you'll never get a case when we ask for it. There's specifically a Stacey Aris case out of Yosemite. By the way, Yosemite, the biggest cluster of missing people in the world that fit our profile. The Stacey Aris case, they said we'd never get it. I asked why, and they said, you just never get it.
You know, this idea that the National Park Service does not keep a list. Does not keep a list of missing people in say Yosemite. It boggles the mind. It makes no sense.
This summer, a friend of mine and I were up at a national park doing some more research, and we were at a little satellite office for this park, and we saw this group of four older gentlemen sitting there talking, and you could tell that they really knew what they were talking about the Park Service, and I kind of got the feeling that one of the guys was either a retired law enforcement man with the Park Service or current law enforcement. I just kind of waited my turn until he walked out into the parking lot, and I walked up to him, and we introduced ourselves, and I said, hey, if you have a minute, can I talk to you? He says, absolutely. He was the nicest person you'd ever want to meet. Turns out that he was a retired special agent for the Park Service. And I told him what I had encountered, the books I had written. I said, why did they take this position? And he says, Dave, it's a lack of integrity. Those were his words exactly. And he said, they should be giving it up, but they don't. He goes, I could tell you about many cases I worked where there were things that were very wrong, and they just dropped the ball, or they compromised themselves, or they did something that was unethical. And he says, it's just flagrant.
You've made the point, Dave, in your books, this one as well, that it would be pretty easy to keep this kind of a list. It's not like some gargantuan task.
I think maybe I said this on one of your shows last time, is that our group, the Can-Am Missing Project, will go out and purchase 183 clipboards for the National Park Service with a binder full of graph paper for each one of those. And we'll mail them to each one of those 183 locations. And we'll have that paper divided up by date, name, location, time, disposition, and this is going to be your list of missing people. And at the end of every month, when various parks send in their monthly report to headquarters, if there's a new missing person, then you just send it in with your monthly report. And somebody with a $500 laptop could keep this list at headquarters. This isn't rocket science. This is very easy to do. I was doing some research in a national park on some other type of deal, and I was talking to some concessionaires in the park, and I kind of knew at the time that the National Park Service personnel wouldn't talk to you, but the people running the stores and things inside the park aren't employees of the Park Service, and they would talk. And I was having some success, and I noticed that during the days, a couple of people were watching me. It's no big deal. They kind of knew that would happen. That night, I was staying at a place off the Park Service property. Get a knock on the door, and there's a couple people standing there. And they said, "Hey, Dave, we're off duty, but we're National Park Service Rangers, and we have a story we want to tell you, and we know who you are, and you're a good investigator, and we just want to give you some info." Kind of leery at the beginning, but they came in. Both of them were really nice people, and they stated that over the years that they had worked at several different national parks, and they had seen a series of disappearances at each of their locations over the years. And at the front end, there was a lot of publicity. There's a lot of activity. That first 7 to 10 days, there's a lot of interest and a lot of news coverage. And after that, it's over. And when they say it's over, it's over. There's really no follow-up. There's really very few other searches. It's like it goes into this hole and it's gone. And it had them concerned because they thought that there was an inordinate amount of missing people at their parks. And they thought that there were certain circumstances inside them that they couldn't identify, but they said it just felt wrong. And they said that rarely would they find somebody, and if they did, they were in places that they shouldn't have been and didn't make sense. So I said, thanks. I listened, asked a few more questions, and after a couple hours, they left. And the next day, I was driving away, and I called a couple of law enforcement guys, and I said, "Hey, pull up these locations and see if you see anything unusual or you see many disappearances." And right away, the response was, "Well, there is something here." And that's kind of the way it got started.
I guess it would be hard. I mean, from the vantage point of all the work you've done now, from this vantage point, you can see the broad patterns. But I guess without the benefit of all the work you've done, unless you're a Park Service Ranger and you see them for year after year, it would be really hard to spot this.
It's really hard. And in the other books, I've explained that at the back of each book, I usually have a index of all the missing people. And I tell people to look at that index and look at the dates and the locations. And there's almost a hopscotch effect on the missing people. There aren't a lot in one location within a short period of time because that would really raise awareness. But if you have one, say, in Yellowstone, and you have another in Great Smoky Mountains, and you have another in the Adirondacks, and they're all about 3 or 4 or 5 days apart, it's not going to raise a lot of suspicion.
And that's what it looks like, is that you'll have the same general location, but they'll wait a couple of years. Whatever it is, it will pick them off in the same spot, but they'll wait for things to settle down.
Correct.
Is there what are the patterns? Talk about the clusters a little bit.
So the biggest cluster in the world is Yosemite. And in the books, I identify that boulders, granite, there's something about being in a boulder field or being around granite that can be dangerous. And a lot of people disappear in those areas. And Yosemite has so many strange disappearances in 3 of my books. It's just unbelievable. In one of the books, I wrote about 2 University of California graduate students that disappeared in the late 1950s. 3 months apart, they didn't know each other. They were brilliant guys. One was vacationing with a family. The other was working there during the summer. They disappeared under very unusual circumstances. Somehow or another, and I don't know how, the family found each other. They didn't know each other in school. They didn't have the same major. Everything about them was different except they were grad students from Cal. The family found each other, and they wrote letters to Eisenhower asking him to send in special forces to search for these two. Well, about 2 weeks ago, from the Eisenhower Library, I got 28 pages of documents about this. And it's very fascinating because one thing became clear is that the Army didn't want anything to do with this. And in fact, they lied in internal documents to the White House saying that they thought that these guys just got picked up on the road and taken out of the park and there was nothing to it. But they never said that to the press, and they never said that to the parents, the best I could tell.
So initially, Yosemite being the biggest cluster, but there are, you started out noticing 28. How many do you think there are now?
There's 58 in North America.
Give me
and
a
the
list.
The unusual part about it, just in the last year, when we started to map the missing people, the Great Lakes comes out right away as almost the entire circumference of the lake at almost even geographical locations, there's a cluster of missing people. And so when you look at the map, what comes out at you is mountains and water. There's clusters in mountains and there's clusters in water, around water.
I guess the further back you go, the more cases you find. I mean, I can't even guess how many the total is now. It's certainly hundreds. Is it thousands?
I think we're at about 1,240 right now.
And you know that there are a lot more. It's just a matter of digging them up.
Oh, absolutely.
After Yosemite, what's the most prominent cluster?
Well, that's a tough one. I would say maybe Colorado, or maybe one of the clusters in Washington, or anywhere through the Cascades. They're all about even after you leave Yosemite. But it's very much far and away the largest.
How many does it take to qualify as a cluster? How many cases? 4, 5, 6?
Yeah, it's three will do it if it's if they're all within that profile and they're all geographically close, and I'm saying within 70 to 80 miles.
For the benefit of those who've heard you before and the benefit of those not familiar with this, let's go down the laundry list of characteristics. What qualifies to count as your kind of a case? What characteristics?
First of all, rural location. No mental illness of the subject or the victim. No water-related death or suspicion of drowning. No criminal suspects in the case. One thing we found just in the last year as well, this has come out and it's very troubling, is that there's people of extremely high intellect that are disappearing, and then there's people with disabilities and very low intellect that are disappearing. People like me, we're in that middle, we're not disappearing at as high a rate. Canines are involved in two different levels. That a lot of people disappear with their dog. And there's a lot of people that disappear and they bring canines, tracking dogs, bloodhounds to the scene, and they can never pick up a scent. 99.5% of the time, they can't pick up a scent. Or they are unwilling to track, or they're afraid. And it's hard to say what of those three it is, but it probably is that there's no scent.
I think that's one of the weirdest aspects. You've told me a couple of the stories. Maybe you can share a typical one where a dog just acts really weird for a dog that lives to track. I mean, that's what they do.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're so excited to get out there on the trail and start doing their job. I can't even tell you how excited they get. And there have been times where the dog gets brought to the trailhead. They're given the victim's scent. The dog walks in a circle and lays down at the handler's feet. They've never seen the dog act like this before, and they can't explain it. Other times, the dog will get there. It'll walk up the trail 50 feet. It'll lay down like, that's it. There's no more. And handlers can't explain it. And I gave a talk in front of NASSER, the National Association of Search and Rescue Professionals, 2 years ago. And at the end, there was a line out the door that wanted to talk. And a large group of handlers came up and said, you know, Dave, handlers don't talk about this much, but you'd be surprised how often this happens to us, and we can't explain why. And the other part of this is that you won't find it in newspaper articles much, and unless the victim is examined by a doctor and a doctor makes a specific public statement about it, but the victims are often found with a low-grade fever. That's an unusual occurrence. It's not something that's normal. And if the victim is found alive, they're either found unconscious or in a semi-conscious state, but very rarely do they have all of their wherewithal about them. And then this one is a big one, and I think it's getting bigger by the day, is that the people are missing shoes predominantly, secondarily clothing. And I know some people are going to say, oh, you know, it's hypothermia, except the people take the clothes off too close to the point where they go missing. And the weather is too nice most of the time for the clothing to come off if they're claiming hypothermia. Secondarily, the people are taking shoes off where they shouldn't be taking shoes off. And that's a real conundrum. And in this new book, there's a couple cases in there where the shoes are off and this person's found dead at the location, and the instances don't make any sense at all. And a couple of the last things is that most of these disappearances occur between, say, 2 p.m. and 6 p.m. That's the vast majority. Somehow or another, berries are involved in many of the cases, blackberries, huckleberries. And in a large, large percentage of these cases, if the victim is found, they're found in an area that has been previously searched. And I'm not talking once, twice, sometimes 50 times. Sometimes they're found unconscious face down on the trail the searchers were taking every day out to search. And lastly, swamps are involved in many of the disappearances on the East Coast. Sometimes the kids are found in the middle of a swamp and nobody can explain how they got there.
You also have some really chilling cases about, in particular about kids, how they are counterintuitive behavior. I mean, they wander distances that are impossible for them to have traversed, and they go into really rough terrain that seemingly they could not possibly travel on their own.
Well, in the new book, there's a graph. There's two graphs in there with elevation and distances that kids have traveled. And it's baffling when you first get into this to think that, say, a 5-year-old girl could travel 75 miles in 4 days, or a 2-year-old boy could travel 12 miles over two mountain ranges in 19 hours. Yet those are the claims made by the searchers that find these people. And this isn't one or two cases. There's quite a few that fit this exorbitant profile where, as a parent, you know it just can't be true.
And they don't go downhill, they go uphill.
Exactly. And in some of the elevation cases, there's one in one of the books I wrote about where David Scott was found 3,000 feet on the east side of Yosemite above a campsite where his parents were camping. His parents told the sheriff at the time, "My boy was abducted, I know he was." And he was found 3,000 feet, almost straight up a mountainside on a switchback, down the other side and then up another mountain, nearly naked, face down, deceased.
These abductions, and we'll use that term for now anyway, they happen right under the noses of parents, in groups where people are hiking along in the woods. I mean, it's not just people wandering out alone getting lost, right?
No, and that's the vast majority of these happen, just like you said, very close to parents. And many times the parents have no idea this is going on. I was at a conference this weekend, and a man was talking to me. He has a couple of young kids, and he goes, "Dave, you know, what you said was chilling, and it makes me think twice about going in the woods." And he says, "You know, I keep my kids in my view all the time, but you know how kids are. Sometimes you got one in front, one behind. You can't see them both." I said, "Exactly. It's difficult." And a lot of these cases, the child is the last person in line, or the first person in line gets just out of view, and they are gone quicker than you can believe.
A matter of seconds.
Matter of seconds, and when the person comes around the turn, there isn't that much ground coverage for them not to be seen, and it doesn't make sense.
I saw your reference in the book to an article that must have been done on Huffington Post where they said, "Don't be the last in line." It's kind of macabre humor, but it's probably true if you take these cases to heart that you list in the book.
Well, exactly, and Roger Marsh wrote an article about that. What concerned him was is that being the last in line in a group or being the last in line in a family, and then you vanish, and then you're not found for days and days and days, and sometimes never found. Imagine the guilt associated with your family members who allowed you to just, you think you're in a safe environment in a county park or a national park, and you're just gone.
It seems like from reading all of the books that the only people or the vast majority of the people who are found alive are those who are unable, for one reason or another, to explain where they were. Either they're too young as kids, which is the big majority of the cases, or they have some kind of disability that prevents them, or they're so disoriented they can't remember anything.
Exactly correct.
And I mean, you think that's why they're allowed to come back, because they can't explain what happened to them?
You know, it goes without saying that that seems to be it. It almost seems like before these people are taken, somehow or another, they know that they have this specific disability. And I'm not talking about overtly obvious disabilities. There's a national or a U.S. Forest Service ranger that disappeared in Arizona. I wrote about in this new book. And he had a sister that had, he had two sisters that had an extremely odd bone disorder. And I'm talking like 1 in 2 million or 1 in 3 million people ever have it. And he was the one person of the three kids that didn't have it. And for some reason, this one article about his disappearance talked about this unique point in his life. And to me, it meant a lot because he didn't have the disability, but there was something about his DNA that excluded him having that disease. And he disappeared. He was never found.
You know, you mentioned about the intellect, either high, people with high intellect, college graduates, high degrees, and those with intellectually challenged people. It's as if they're, something is culling the herd. Hey, let's pick off the best and the brightest, and while we're at it, we'll pick off the weakest and the easiest to grab.
That's a sad way to put it, but I think that after you read all of the books, I think you're going to come to that conclusion whether you want to or not.
It's not mountain lions, right?
So when a search and rescue team goes into an area, one of the first things they do is they bring in trackers, they bring in canines that look for mountain lions and things, and they're looking for that obvious sign of a fight, of a struggle, blood, hair, disturbed ground. That's one of the things that's excluded on the front end. None of these cases are associated with that.
There's no no shredded clothes. The bodies that are found are not ripped to shreds or eaten, or I guess there have been some of those, but they don't fit the classic definition of the ones you're looking at.
No, and the coroners come to conclusions that, no, they're not eaten by bears. No, they're not eaten by mountain lions, or mountain lion experts come in and make decisions that this person wasn't attacked by a mountain lion for A, B, C, and D.
And so if it were mountain lions or bears or people, the dogs would be able to track them.
Exactly.
You're getting a lot of attention these days, and I think it's long overdue. I mean, in addition to the review from Whitley, you were featured in an article in the Huffington Post. You've done a bunch of radio shows. I know that there was this article. I was utterly amazed to see that there's an article written by you for the MUFON Journal because, and I say it this way, not because it's not justified, but because UFO folks over the years have been pretty careful about avoiding any kind of cross-pollinization with other mysteries. They like their aliens and saucers to stay in a neat little category all their own, not get mixed up with other weirdness. So how did that happen?
Well, that's an interesting story. The editor for the MUFON Journal had received the initial narrative I wrote about this, and he took it to the board of directors for the exact reasons that you explained, and he wanted them to review it and see if it fit. And he said it was overwhelming that they wanted it in, and they were going to push stories off of the front page for the 2 months and put it in right now. So it came out just within the last couple of days. And he said that they're having discussions to make this one of the priority items that they maybe should focus on moving forward and not ignore it.
Well, that's great because, I mean, I know that field pretty well, and those guys can be very stodgy. Those guys and gals, I should say, can be very stodgy about expanding the parameters of the mysteries that they explore. How does this fit in, though? I read the article. I don't want to give the whole thing away. And for those who don't subscribe to the journal, maybe you can give us sort of a synopsis how it fits in with the UFO mystery.
Well, I'm not trying to put a square peg in a round hole, but we read so many different journals, prospecting journals, MUFON journals, everything. Every once in a while, you come across a coincidence that's just too much to ignore. And I didn't draw any conclusions to this. I just brought them to this coincidence that they can't ignore. And how it came about is several months ago, one of the researchers in MUFON went to an area called Cape Fear, North Carolina. And I think something that we've written about in the past is that these incidents happen near locations where their names will strike you as unusual. Mm-hmm. Devil's Peak, Cape Fear. When I saw that right away, I thought, well, that's kind of weird. Wonder how that got its name. And this investigator wrote this article about an incident where two men and a boy were fishing along the Cape Fear River. It's kind of near an area of Hope Mills, North Carolina. And they separated briefly, And this young boy happened to see some orbs, some lights in the trees, as he was walking alone. And it turns out that this man, who was separate from him at the time, saw the same thing. And this was his dad. And as they got further apart, the boy ended up seeing what he described as two humanoids on the ground around this fire pit, kind of examining the area. And above it was this light hovering above them, maybe 200 yards or less when he first saw it. And then he kind of converged on it and got this close-up of these humanoids. Well, the boy and his dad got together. He explained what he saw. They decided to go home. And they went to an area about 16 miles west of Roseboro, North Carolina, where their house was at. And it's called Gray's Creek. And they went home. At about 1:30 that morning, the MUFON investigator used these two words I've never heard before. He said a vibrational tremor came over the house, and something was above the house, and it woke the dad. The dad went outside, and the dog was already outside, but when he opened the door, their dog took off on a dead run into the woods, and he went into the woods to look for the dog. Well, there was a lot of things that came out of this, and MUFON sent a special team out to interview these people. And the dad and the son agreed to go under reverse hypnosis to figure out what happened. And then the father ended up agreeing to take a polygraph exam on it, too. And they ended up passing the polygraph. And during the regression, the father, it turns out, was abducted from this riverside setting when he saw this orb and these lights. So he's abducted, goes up to a ship. The specifics are a bit unclear, but he confirms it in that polygraph. Now step back for a second. In our work, we deal with rural disappearances with a set of criteria. And that criteria can be people with disabilities, people that disappear with canines, missing or found, and they disappear near bodies of water. And sometimes they disappear in one of the 34 geographical clusters we've identified in North America. Inclement weathers associated with the disappearances. Swamps, briar patches play a predominant role. In a vast majority of the cases, these occur in the late afternoon or evening. If the missing are found alive, majority of the time, they either refuse to discuss the incident or they don't remember the incident. And a vast majority of the times, they're found semi-conscious or unconscious. And the last one is many of the missing are found in areas previously searched, sometimes as much as 50 times. Sometimes they're found on the main trail coming back to the search and rescue location. Last one I forgot to mention was berries are inextricably related somehow with the disappearance. Sometimes their kids found eating them. Sometimes the people are out berry picking and they vanish. Going back to this instance. There were a couple of cases, and this is highly, highly unusual, that two small boys disappear from the same town. One of the things that I explain in the books is it's very hard to understand how this phenomena was discovered because there's usually 20 or 30 years sometimes between the disappearances if they're in the same area. So it's almost like a generation of, say, law enforcement has already cycled through. And the next group in isn't going to remember the last time it happened.
I commend the MUFON Journal for being willing to explore this, you know, because it does open them up probably to criticism, but it's courageous to go ahead and follow the evidence, to follow the evidence that you've accumulated. And I know you've been very careful, very meticulous about not giving an answer, not saying what your pet theory is or even giving any kind of indication at all what you think of it. But by putting this article in the MUFON Journal, you're making comparisons to what we know as alien abduction stories. I mean, it's inevitable that people would say, hey, maybe there's a connection there.
Well, I think it would be negligent on our part not to identify the coincidence. And I put a list together this morning. I was going through all the emails we had about some of the things that people have focused on in the past and said, hey, Dave, you've nailed it. You guys have really exposed what's going on here. It's obvious, and here's some of the things that people have said. It's Dogman, it's reptilians, it's aliens, it's Bigfoot, Sasquatch, skinwalkers, serial killers in the woods, Mothman, and a list of a variety of crypto creatures. And if you start thinking about all these things, it's hard to be an expert in all those areas. And what I tell people is that your mind kind of goes where that comfort level's at and where your knowledge base is at. And that's one thing that we try not to do, is we try to read as much literature from these various areas that we can, because it's a complex issue. And there are no easy answers here. And I've never had anybody say, oh yeah, after they've read the book, you know, the strangest one we had was somebody said, well, it's obvious that there's some park rangers that are serial killers that are in their parks. And if you look at the number of years that are between some of these disappearances, there's 100 years in some areas, 120 years. So that throws out that theory.
Well, there are comparisons. I mean, there are similarities to the stories we've heard over the years about alien abductions. Some of the cases you described, especially in the first two books of Missing 411, it's as if these victims are plucked out of the sky and dropped somewhere, you know, as if by saucers or eagles or pterodactyls or something, right?
Oh, no. And some of the, one of the things when we first got started with this, we try to learn as much as we can about search and rescue and setting grids and their parameters that they use. And there's a couple books out there that tell you, okay, if a child is between the age of 1 and 3, you know, they'll be found at 95% of the time in 2.8 miles or less from the point they're last seen. Well, one of the things that we found is that the majority of the cases we work blow those numbers completely out of the water. There's a couple of cases that I talk about in this recent book, where a couple of girls disappear. One was found, I think, 75 miles away. They were on foot. She was dead. And then her sister was found, I think, 12 or 15 miles away. And these were fairly young girls. But then there's also cases right on the fringe of Yosemite where a 2-year-old boy disappears, and he climbs not one mountain. He climbs one mountain, goes down the backside of another and up another, over 3,000 feet for a 2-year-old kid. And there's a lot of these examples, just like you said. Anyone with any rational sense knows that they're not going to get there on their own, especially if you have kids. And, you know, kids are going to take normally 95% of the time, the path of least resistance, downhill.
We haven't covered this yet about the factors that you use to sort of exclude cases that come your way, because I can hear people's minds clicking. Oh, hi, it's a serial killer. It's pot farmers out there in the national forest. It's mountain lions. It's bears. I mean, you're pretty meticulous about weeding those out. And cases that would meet those kind of characteristics, you don't consider them. You don't put them into your database, right?
Absolutely. And we exclude a lot just because of that. So first of all, if there's any type of mental illness or suicide thoughts that go with the case, we don't work it. If there's any possibility that the child or the adult might have been washed away in a river or drowned in a lake, we won't work it. And the reason for that is that you want to take the ambiguity away if it's one of those cases. And it's real easy to pull the trigger on one of those cases and say, oh, yeah, that's what's happened. But if you just eliminate them, and I know we're probably eliminating some cases that could be here, the reality of it is it's just our safety mechanism. One of the other big things, any incident where it could have been an animal attack, we won't work it. And those are, I've heard a lot of people discuss this and say, well, you know, a mountain lion running 20 miles an hour can knock a kid out of his socks. But when a mountain lion or a bear attack a human, there's usually some carnage there. There's hair, there's a scene in the dirt, there's blood. There's a lot that goes on there that can be readily identifiable for somebody who knows what they're looking for. And when search and rescue gets on the scene, it's one of the first things they're looking for. When trackers get on a scene, it's one of the first things they're looking for, coupled with the type of tracks that are in that area from a type A predator, bear, mountain lion, etc. So if that was ever thought of, then we throw that case out. One of the things that is a criteria on ours is that a canine can't track scent on these cases 99.5% of the time. Sometimes they get put on the track where the person was last seen. Sometimes the canines walk in a circle and lay down. Sometimes they walk around and the handler will say, I've never seen that before. My dog wasn't even interested. Or my dog, I've heard this before, my dog acts afraid. So it's very unusual behavior because these tracking dogs live for this stuff. And if anyone's ever been around one or helped train one, they know, I mean, they're going out of their minds. They want to do this. They're excited. Not in these cases.
You mentioned about the dog connection on the other side of it, where the two cases on the East Coast where the dogs disappeared with the boys and then came back. Is the dog connection as part of the disappearance? Does that happen fairly frequently? I know I saw a couple of other cases in the book where dogs are involved and the dogs vanish as well. Is it always that the dogs come back, or they mostly disappear as well with the child or the individual?
I'd say 90 to 95% of the time they come back. A lot of the times the dog, if the child's found, a lot of times the dog is found with the child. But then there are times where the parents will say, hey, the dog and my child are inseparable, and the dog will come back. They try to get the dog to go back and help them look, and the dog won't go back. And the parents say, I can't believe I'm seeing this. Other times, the dogs will go back, and they'll take them to a spot, and the child's not there. And then a couple days later, the child's found on the main trail, say, search and rescue are looking for the child on. And how that child got there, nobody understands.
And had been searched 50 times.
Right.
There's a case that jumps out at me in the new book, The Missing 411 North America and Beyond, because it happened right near maybe a couple of miles from where I was born. It's in New Jersey. And it's not exactly the same as the other cases. This didn't happen in some national forest. But it's perplexing, and it, too, involves a dog, the little girl in the closet. Tell me that story.
So that's an unusual case for a couple of reasons. And the reason we included it is because of the house backs up to kind of a wildlife area and a creek area. And a lot of the cases that we work involve creeks and rivers and kids either going missing while in that creek, and I don't mean drowned or washed away, or later on they're found there. And as many of the listeners have identified to us, and we get it, is that a creek, especially a dry creek bed or a river that's shallow, if you walk up that creek or you walk down that creek in that river, the chances of anyone finding any footprints or tracks are almost zero. So that's a very efficient way to move through an area and not be identified. This girl, Mary Jane Barker, 3 years old, she was playing in her backyard on February 25th, 1957 in the morning hours. And she was in a place called Bellmawr, B-E-L-L-M-A-W-R, New Jersey, and it's just across the river from Philly. And her mom came out, looked at her. She's playing in the backyard with her Cocker Spaniel. Her mom comes out 5-10 minutes later. The dog's gone. The girl's gone. And she can't believe it because she thought she had everything locked up solid. And she looked in the back, the creek, didn't see anything. Started to get some neighbors together. They searched. They quickly called the police. The police come out. And essentially, 3 days of searching, and the police start to bring up this word kidnapping again. Now, the dog's gone, and the girl's gone. So they start to spread out more, and they bring in some professional trackers. And on that fourth day, they think that they see an area in that creek bed, and they think they see some tracks of a large man with a dog and a child. They're not sure, but they think so. So we're going into the sixth day now. And this is an area that's not really developed yet. There's a few houses scattered in the area, not a lot. And 2 blocks away, people were building a new house. Now, you got to remember, the area out probably a mile has been searched 5 or 6 times. These houses that are being built have been searched 5 or 6 times. Well, the house was going up for sale, and a mom and a daughter, unknown to the victim's family, was inside this new house looking at it. And this little girl opens up a closet door, and Mary Jane's dog bolts out of the closet and jumps on the little girl. And inside the closet is Mary Jane, deceased. So they call on the sheriff. They do an autopsy, and it shows that Mary Jane hadn't eaten anything for 6 days. But the strange thing about this was the police chief confirmed that that house in that area had been searched 3 times minimum. And the very odd thing is that there was no excrement inside that closet from a dog or her. And the workers that said they'd been in that house almost every day, and they never heard any sounds, and they never heard any barks, nothing. So the coroner thought initially, well, she just must have been in there, and he can't explain why there's no excrement. They actually brought in a veterinarian, and the veterinarian found out the dog hadn't been trained about where to defecate, where not to, and he had absolutely no explanation why there was no excrement from the dog or anything in that closet. So the question comes up, was she in that closet for 6 days? Was the dog in that closet for 6 days? And if they weren't, where were they, and how long had they been in there?
And how searchers would have missed them as well.
Well, that's a common theme that you'll see, and trust me, I am not saying that the searchers are missing these people. I don't believe it, because in a large percentage of the cases we turn here is that people make the statement, but we search this area 5 times. We search this area 10 times. We search this area 50 times, and they weren't there. They come back the 51st time. There they are.
It's as if the victims are taken. They're taken somewhere else, and then they're brought back and sort of dumped.
Kind of the way it appears.
Tell me this. Are you making any headway? We can talk about the National Park Service a little bit later if you want, but just to summarize our previous interviews, you've presented a lot of this evidence about clusters, in particular in national parks. The National Park Service is not only uninterested, but hostile to you. I was wondering if you've made any headway with local police agencies who are investigating missing persons cases. It seems to me they would be maybe more sympathetic or more willing to hear what you had to say.
And many of them are. But you got to understand the mentality of the police. And I think the best example how to understand what we're doing is in this latest article in the Huffington Journal, the reviewer said, "This what's happening here is not going to jump out at you in the first 15 or 30 pages. But after you read 10 to 15 cases, you're going to see a pattern evolve, and then you're going to have this moment where the light goes on in your head and you say, I get it."
Right.
And it's hard to explain in an hour or two, but I can tell you, and I'm sure you realize it, George, that there's circumstances in these cases that you can't ignore that kind of run right underneath all of them. And when you start to look at the clusters, and the timing of the clusters and the disappearances and the facts, you start to realize, wow, this is like profiling. This is like what the FBI does when they're trying to find a serial killer. They're looking for these underlying elements so they can tie these cases together. It's kind of what we're doing here. As far as law enforcement, it's very hard to explain to them what we're doing other than we're just investigating missing people. Some of the jurisdictions are super, super helpful. Others, they're kind of questioning sometimes whether you're going to out them for doing a bad job, and sometimes they hold the information back. A few of them, you can't believe how much information they'll give you. A few of these cases, they gave us crime scene photos on them. And I work with a guy named Harvey Pratt from the Oklahoma Bureau of Investigation. He used to be their director. He's a forensic artist, one of the smartest guys in the world I've ever known that's an investigator. And we spend days sometimes kicking this information around because it doesn't make sense. And yes, these agencies are helping us, but the Park Service, if anything, they've gone the other way. They don't want to help. And when they bring tracking dogs in, canines, bloodhounds, they do strange things. And a lot of times, they can't even find a scent. But at other times, when you read the search and rescue logs or you read the articles in the papers from years and years ago, every once in a while, there's something very critical in there that a lot of writers and a lot of search and rescue people won't put in, but that is the dog sits down and won't search. It'll walk up to a fork in a trail, and it'll just stop. And the handler will put a note in there, unusual, dog won't move, or dog doesn't feel like searching, or whatever it might be. The other part that's unusually strange, and search and rescue people have faced this hundreds of times, and that is that the canine or the bloodhound will track to a river. And we're talking a big river, a tough one for you and I to cross, but any kid under 10 would never cross it. And they track it to a river. Well, assessment is the kid went in the river, kid drowned. And that's essentially the end of the search. If they're really thorough, and this has happened a couple times, they'll dam the river, get permission from Fish and Game, shut it down, and search. And every one of the times they've done that, they never find the missing child. Now, a few of the times, under very unusual circumstances, search and rescue professional says, you know, we'll search the other side just for the heck of it. And son of a gun, if not on the other side, miles away, they find the kid. Now, how did the kid cross the river? Now, search and rescue people won't answer it, and it's left in the dark, and it's never answered in a report. But the question is, how did the kid get across?
It's not only rivers. I should say that that's the, I think that was the eeriest part of the book, is reading about the distance that some of these kids travel, dead of winter, no shoes on. They are found, and they're going counterintuitively up mountains. Talk about that in generalities, and then we'll get into it in specifics.
So in the search and rescue world, there's parameters that are set down based on topography, whether it's hilly ground, flat ground, river, water, cold, wet, dry, hot. And they base it on the age, the health, and on these topographical conditions about how far to set out the grid pattern. And many, and we'll talk about kids here, many of these times in these cases, these kids are found way, way outside the parameters. And I'm not talking 25% outside. I'm talking several hundred percent outside. And just like you said, one of the common themes that you'll read about in these stories is that the kids are found without shoes. Now, what I keep looking to find in the reports is when the child's found, I want to know what the condition of their feet are. But it's never mentioned. Because my question is that if their feet walked 14 miles over three mountain ranges in 14 hours at the age of 8 years old, well, those feet must be destroyed. But they never mention it. And if you read the guidelines on the search and rescue versus what's found here, they make completely no sense. And I think a lot of times the search and rescue people are perplexed, but they do an extremely competent job with the parameters that they have. And when they reach these cases that are completely outside the norm, I think many times the kids may never be found because there's no rational reason to search out that far.
One of the other things, I will talk about this generally too and then get specifics as we go along, is the clothing. You mentioned about having kids being having no shoes on, that you would find pieces of clothing here or there, but there's some really weird stuff goes on with clothing that further perplexes the whole thing, in that, you know, a bear attacks somebody and eats them, there are going to be bits and pieces of clothing show up in the scat. It doesn't happen in these cases. In fact, some of the clothes look like they're taken off and just folded there, kind of thing.
Yeah, there's several cases where people are eaten up and there's just bits and pieces of them, and they find a pair of pants nearby where one of the pant legs or both pant legs are turned inside out as though something has taken the pants off of the people before they ate them. And then scat nearby of a bear is analyzed, and there's no human remains in the scat, and there's no clothing remains. And later we can talk about a case out of the Yukon Territory with a really famous guy named Bart Schleyer, exactly what happened. Another case out of northern Canada with a young girl, same thing happened. Now, if I talked about this by itself, say Schleyer's case or the girl in northern Canada, no one would think much about it, and it was an anomaly. But I know that nobody has ever put multiple cases together like this and said, wow, what's happening? This can't be coincidence. There's got to be a reason. Somebody wrote to me a while ago, and they said, Dave, we just read your book, and oh my God, this applies. And it's a theme out of James Bond. And he said, once is happenstance, twice is coincidence, three time is enemy action. And that's kind of what I think sometimes with this, because it happens too many times to be coincidence.
Well, as I said, we're going to get into specifics. I intentionally want to focus, after this break, I want to focus on the National Park Service, federal agencies, I guess, including the FBI, because am I correct in putting it this way, that you ran into a stone wall right from the get-go?
That'd be a fair assessment.
And so were you able to, I can't tell if you were able, I know a lot of these files, you rely on media reports, so you know that these incidents happen, but did you ultimately fail in getting all the information that you wanted to get using Freedom of Information?
So one thing I say in the book is that the people that work in the park that you and I see when we drive in, those people are phenomenal. They service us. They work for the good of the park service. They know nothing about what we're talking about. I'm talking about probably the top 15 people in the park service know what we're talking about right now and know what they're doing, and they're doing it methodically and logically. And that is that they, when we first started off, we knew that the Park Service had one of the largest federal contingent law enforcement groups of any that patrol open spaces. With a law enforcement group that size, and the number of, there's over 350 different monuments, parks, et cetera, that they patrol, they've got to have a pretty good database of knowledge. And we have the Freedom of Information Act that's given to us by the government, where we can retrieve information and data from our federal agencies. Almost all of them have a website, and almost all of them have a missing person aspect to that site, meaning that they list the people missing in that jurisdiction, date, time, location, et cetera. And it allows the public to keep an eye out for these people, let you know what's going on in the community, et cetera. Well, the National Park Service has a big website, and it has a lot of things on it. There's no missing person website portion to that website. There's no links. There's no mention of it anywhere. But, you know, with the knowledge that if I was running a national park and I had limited resources, I'd buy a clipboard with some graph paper, and every time somebody disappeared, I'd write their name down, the location they disappeared, age, etc. And that, if that would be the inexpensive way to keep a ledger of who was missing. If I could afford a laptop, I could keep 5,000 locations of people missing, and every month when the monthly reports roll in from the National Park Service's other locations to headquarters, I could easily keep track of that on a laptop. Well, through FOIA, we've filed a request to have a list of missing people inside their system. And this went through the Western Regional Office out of Denver, and a woman named Charis, C-H-A-R-I-S Wilson, she is a phenomenal person. She's done us a lot of, she does everything she can to help us, and she's running into a bureaucratic headstorm. And she sends me back a message after we make the request, and she says, Dave, headquarters says they don't have any lists. Well, All of us in law enforcement think, wait, it must be semantics. It can't be true. So I filed it a second time, rewording it. She comes back again, and she says, Dave, I'm really sorry. They say they don't have any lists of any missing people. And I says, okay, how about individual parks? And she says, headquarters says, as far as they know, no parks keep lists of missing people. And I says, okay, if somebody's pretty close to my house, that's a pretty big national park, they should have sufficient resources to do this, FOIA Yosemite and ask them. They come back and said, nope, Yosemite has no lists of missing people. So in FOIA, there's an exemption to get data if you're a published author. So I'm not a world-famous author. I'm just your measly little author of two books. I asked for an author's exemption, and I asked for the data from Yosemite on missing people and to give me that data. They come back, and an attorney through FOIA for the Park Service says that my books aren't in enough libraries to get the publishers and authors exemption from paying the price. So one of the guys we work with, he was the head of a state's law enforcement branch. He's a really, really smart guy. And we sat down and we talked about this, and he said, Dave, these people are not stupid. They obviously don't want the public to know, and they obviously don't want you to have it. And that's probably the best way it could be put.
So how did you get all the files then?
Well, that's a monumental piece of work right there. So every community just outside of a national park or a national monument keeps pretty good tabs on what happens. And the choice is you either go there and you sit in a library and you work it out, and you get in tight with the librarian and you say, hey, do you have a lot of these libraries have files specifically for certain things. And some of these libraries had those files on missing people. And there's certain archive sites on the web that you can subscribe to. And if you're patient enough, and if you have the time, and you know how to query, you can get certain data out of there that's available. And through all of the above, in 3+ years worth of work, eventually this started to roll in.
So, for example, once you get a name of a missing person, say from a newspaper article, are you able to use that name and then force the file out of the Park Service or some other agency?
Sometimes, yes. It usually works the other way. You query, say, missing Glacier National Park. And sometimes it'll go back 30, 40, 50 years on some of the archived locations. Other times, not. And then you get the name and you FOIA the national park for the file. Now, the interesting thing about that is one of the clusters of disappearances is Crater Lake. So we FOIA'd Crater Lake on a series of disappearances there. And again, Cheris from Denver comes back and says, Dave, I'm embarrassed to tell you, we lost all the files in 12 years at that park.
Huh. Oops.
Said, come on. And she goes, no, we really don't have them. I mean, I believe her because I believe what she's saying is the truth. But where are they?
Now that they know that they should have one of these, and they know you're going to stir up a lot of trouble over the fact that they don't have one, any response from them indicating they're putting one together or any indication that they're budging from this, this horrendous position?
So starting 3.5, approaching 4 years ago when this all started, they told me back then that they were obtaining a grant to start an intensive computer network amongst all of their parks, and this was something that they were going to implement. But like I told you at the beginning, this isn't rocket science, George. I mean, honest to God, with a clipboard and a graph piece of graph paper, you could start tracking this today. And then every month, each park or each monument sends in a report to National Park Headquarters. Well, somebody's reading these. Somebody's taking notes and deriving statistical data. And knowing that missing people is a hot topic, that you would think that those statistics would be very important.
One other question on this. You got a call from some agent for the Park Service who went beyond just saying no to you. I mean, he really gave you some attitude, and you detail that in the book. Tell me about that.
So Yosemite is one of the biggest clusters of missing people anywhere. And if anyone's been to Yosemite, yeah, there's a lot of rock walls, there's a lot of canyons and things. But again, these disappearances don't fall into the realm of normality in any shape, way, or form. And I live in a suburb of San Jose, right near a city called Saratoga. And it just so happens a 15-year-old girl from Saratoga went missing in the early 1980s on a trip with her dad. And she was on horseback, and her dad were with seven other people. And they rode into a remote area called Sunrise Camps, just outside of Tenaya Lake. And they were about 8,000, 9,000 feet up. And they rode into an area where there are remote cabins that you can stay at. Her name's Stacy, gets off her horse. Her dad gets off her horse. She goes in the cabin. She changes. And there's a 71-year-old man that went along with the group, and she tells her dad, hey, I'm going to go with Mr. So-and-so, and we're going to walk out here to this point 100 feet away that everybody could see, and she brought her camera, and she's going to take some pictures. And the man walks out, and it's high elevation, and he tells Stacy, hey, I'm tired. I'm just going to sit down right here. Everybody sees the man sit down. Stacy tells the man, hey, I'm going to walk down this trail, and it's a very easy trail. It's almost all granite outcropping, very few trees. And I'm going to this lake that almost everybody can see. And she has to walk through a few trees to get to the lake. The man says he sees her walk through the trees, and she doesn't come back. And a large search ensues. And in years and years, they never find anything of Stacy. The only thing they found of hers was right inside that tree line. They found the cap to her camera, her lens cap. And that story intrigued me for several reasons. First of all, it's in an area of Yosemite that doesn't have a lot of trees. There's not a lot of places to hide. The elevation's high. There's a lot of lakes in that area. But it's an unusual case. A 15-year-old girl just vanishes. And to not find a body, not find clothing, not find shoes, something about her is really an unusual event. So I filed a FOIA against the Park Service. And this is probably the 25th or 28th time we filed one on an open missing persons case, meaning the person wasn't found. And just so the audience understands, a missing persons case in law enforcement is not considered a criminal event. it's one of those strange things that the police departments and sheriffs and law enforcement in general investigate, even though it's not a crime for a person to go missing. So it's not a crime. And we get almost 99.9% of all the FOIAs we ask for when the person is still missing. And the only one we've never gotten back is Stacy. And we got a refusal. So I went back to Cheris in Denver. I said, Cheris, what's going on? She goes, Dave, I don't know. It doesn't make sense to me. Yosemite's being strange about this. So it gets back to the special agent, and that's the detective for the Park Service that does follow-up. And at about this time, there's a book written about life and death in Yosemite by a retired ranger named Butch Farabee. And Butch spent 30 years at various national parks. And there's so much death and strange events going on in Yosemite. He wrote a masterful book about it. And it wasn't just about deaths. It was about disappearances and things. And Butch wrote about Stacy. So I called him. I said, Butch, this is what I'm doing. It's a little different than yours. My scope's a little wider, but you did a great job on your book, and I want to know what happened with Stacy. He says, Dave, I saw the file. There shouldn't be any reason you don't have it. They looked at a lot of people at the time. There's no suspects. There's no nothing, Dave. I don't think they have anything on this, and I doubt if anybody's looked at it in 25 or 30 years. Well, out of the blue, I get this call from a special agent in Yosemite. And he says, right off the bat, he says, what do you want this file for? Well, if you know, when you go asking for something, you know the law behind it before you start looking. And we know the law. And one of the criteria is, in FOIA, the rationale on why you want something from the government can't be a reason why they ask. Or why they grant or why they deny, and they can't even ask. This guy asked. I said, well, why are you asking me that? He says, hey, I know who you are, and I know your background, and I want to know why you want it. I says, well, I want it because I'm looking at missing people. I'm writing a book about missing people. Her case is highly unusual, and it's in my backyard. He says, well, you're not going to get it. I said, what do you mean I'm not going to get it? It's an open missing persons case. And I said, is there any criminal element to that? Nope. I said, are there any suspects? Nope. I said, well, why wouldn't you give it to me then? And he says, well, because we never give away these cases. I says, wait a minute. I have dozens and dozens of these cases from your agency all over the U.S. He goes, no, you don't. But yes, I do. And we get into this talk, and he challenges me. He's rude. He says right from the get-go, I'm never going to get this. And so far, he's right. I've appealed this to the National Park Service. I've gone to a congressman. They cannot get that file. Today, out of the blue, I get a call from the cousin of George Aris, who since is deceased, who actually went to the scene when Stacy disappeared and helped with the search efforts. And I explained to him what's going on. And he says he's going to try to intervene on behalf of the family to find out why this case isn't getting opened and released. And he's upset about it. So the point being is that, I mean, if you have nothing to conceal, why not show it? The agent said, well, if I give you the case, that'll compromise any future prosecution. The prosecution for what? Most of the people involved in this are dead. The 71-year-old man is long gone. Her dad's long gone. Half the people involved that were on that trip are deceased. Do you have a suspect? No. Are you investigating a crime? No. It's baffling.
Tell me this. Within your research, were you able to develop relationships with NPS staff members, former, maybe retired folks who would talk to you off the record about this? And if so, were you able to get any idea why they would cover this up? I mean, they must have some kind of idea what's going on. Either that or they just don't want to alarm the public so people would stop going to national parks.
So the perspective is that the average National Park Service employee is having a difficult life enough just doing their job day in and day out, and their vision of things is probably from 1,000 feet. You and I right now are rolling at 50,000 feet and looking at 350-plus different locations and seeing things from an entirely different perspective. The people, I would say, like I said, 99.5% of the Park Service doesn't have any fathom of a thought what you and I are discussing right now, and I don't blame them in the least for what's happening. It's that top realm in the Park Service that knows. One of the conversations I had was with the head of the Law Enforcement Bureau for the National Park Service. He kind of laughed and joked when I started to talk about the same things you and I are talking about here. Same thing. Well, Dave, people disappear. You know, it's not unusual. We deal with hundreds and hundreds of these events. And then they throw out this thing that you're going to hear many times, and I'm sure we're all going to hear it in the next few weeks. Do you know how many millions of people visit our park and have a safe trip? And I told them, I said, you know what? I know that is true, but the reality is that the Harris family had their life ruined. The Dennis Martin family in the Great Smoky Mountains had their life ruined. The Trini Gibson family in the Great Smoky Mountains had their life ruined. The Dennis Johnson family in Yellowstone National Park had their life ruined. And you know what? I don't care if you had 20 million people there. Something happened to those kids, and they were never found inside your system. So to throw around big numbers like that you have so many millions of visitors, it only takes one to ruin your whole life, and that ruined these people's lives. And they have no advocates, and they're not on any database. Why?
It would be like the FAA saying, yeah, I know, we had this terrible air disaster, and a plane crashed and killed 200 people, but most planes don't crash. They land safely, you know?
Same analogy. Exactly.
The other part of that question was whether you were able to develop any confidential sources within NPS or former folks who worked for them.
So in Crater Lake, there's a cluster of young men and boys that have disappeared. And these disappearances go back nearly 100 years to an individual named B.B. Bukowski, who back when the park was just very, very young, he pulled a sled in the middle of winter and was going to, he's a landscape photographer, and he was taking photos of the lake, first time anyone had ever done it during the winter. And Bukowski was a pretty strong guy. He built a snow cave. He had all of his equipment there. Inexplicably.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.